The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Today I'd like to speak about the second faculty, the faculty of energy. And and this is translated in various ways. The Pali term is virya, and it can be translated as strength, as Gil translated it the other day, as courage. And this is an interesting exploration to think about this aspect of bringing our energy to our experience as having a quality of courage to it. And then, of course, the translation of energy. And much as Gil described for faith yesterday, faith he described as a quality of mind that it's not something we actually do. It's not something we kind of can just pick up and do it. We can sometimes incline our minds towards that quality, but generally it's a quality that has its strength based on what's happening in our hearts and in our minds. Energy is kind of similar in that way. It's a mental factor that we don't actually do. Rather, there's a certain amount of energy that's present in your being because you are alive. And then the understanding about the spiritual faculty of energy is that it's the way that we use that energy, the way that we direct that energy, that makes a difference. If we direct our energy wisely, whatever energy that we have, if we direct that wisely, it will create more energy for us. It will create wise energy for us. So there's this importance, as I spoke about the other day, of what is it that we are directing our spiritual faculties towards? What is it that we are taking faith in? What is it that we are applying our energy towards? So the importance of wisdom. What are we trying to do with our minds, with our hearts? Energy itself is actually a neutral quality of mind. The same quality in our minds, this quality of energy, is responsible or fuels desire, aggression, ambition on the one hand, and on the other hand, it also is the kind of the support for compassion, for generosity, for kindness. So it's important to look at what is it that we're doing with our energy? How is it that we're directing that? And the Buddha offered us some guidelines, some wise guidelines for this. Some principles to guide us in how we might live wisely, use this energy wisely. It's said that after the Buddha's awakening, that he looked out at the world, looked at what people were doing in their lives, looked at how they were directing their energy, and that he saw they were engaged in trying to become happy, that this is, you know, this seems to be a very natural aspiration that we have, to be happy, and that the things that people were doing they thought were things that would make them happy. But he saw, after his understanding, after his exploration in his own mind of what brings happiness and what brings suffering, he saw that what people were doing was actually the very things that would get in the way of happiness. Our usual worldview, a simplified version of our usual worldview, is something like having certain things, if I have these things, if I get rid of those things, where those things are different for each of us perhaps, but if I have certain things, if I can construct my world in a certain way, then I will be happy. Or a variation on that might be, if people can see me in a certain way, then I'll be happy. And the Buddha recognized that this perspective, this way of approaching happiness, is intimately tied up with the reason why we feel dissatisfaction, the reasons why we feel struggle, reasons why we have stress in our lives. Intimately tied up with this fact of dukkha in our lives, the Pali word that's usually translated as suffering. But it's really a very broad acknowledgement. This dukkha is a broad acknowledgement of not just what we'd normally think of as suffering, you know, not the big things that we would put the English word suffering on, but also the subtle things, the little stresses, the little dissatisfactions, this subtle sense of unease also come under this term of dukkha. So this usual way that we approach happiness, essentially what we're doing is we're pinning our hopes on happiness by being able to manipulate the world, to construct things around us, to somehow figure out how to get other people to think and feel about us the way we'd like them to. So we're pinning our hopes for happiness on things that are pretty unreliable. And this is really the place where the Buddha said, you know, this is why we suffer so much. Because where we are pinning our hopes for happiness, essentially what we are putting our faith in, is unreliable. There, pretty much everything in experience is impermanent, is destined to pass away, to come in and go out of being. And if we are counting on relying on things in the world, impermanence will give us the lesson we need to show that that's not a very reliable place to have our happiness. And how reliable is it to want other people to see us in a certain way, relying on other people's minds? We see just how changeable, as we sit down in meditation, just how changeable and conditioned our own minds are. We want to really depend on what other people's minds do for our happiness. So the Buddha's awakening, in my understanding, is that it was partly around a deep understanding of the nature of this dukkha and the cause. What is it that causes this suffering, struggle, distress, dissatisfaction, unease, suffering? What is it that causes it? And his recognition was that most of what we call suffering is arising in our own minds. Now, some of what we call suffering, sometimes we call physical pain suffering. And there is physical pain that is going to be happening. Now, that's not going to change with our shift of perspective. But actually, a lot of even what we call physical pain is exacerbated by our reaction to it. So the Buddha points us to exploring and understanding in our own mind, what is it that leads us into this struggle? To explore for ourselves. His awakening was around understanding for himself in his own experience. How is suffering caused? How is suffering created in my own mind? And he encourages us to make this exploration. So one of the key perspectives that he brings for us to, or frameworks that he brings for us to explore is to look at what in our experience kind of heads us in the direction of unease, dissatisfaction, stress, suffering, struggle. What is it that heads us in the direction of dukkha? And what is it that heads us in the direction of ease, peace, happiness? So from this perspective, he looks at the words kusala. What's kusala? What's wholesome? What's skillful? The term kusala is often translated as wholesome, but Tanisaro Bhikkhu also points out that this word kusala, kusala mind states are ones that help take us towards happiness. And this word kusala is also used in artisans, people who do a craft. People who are very skilled at a craft are kusala at that craft. They're skilled at that craft. And so another translation or another way to look at this is, what is skillful? What supports us? What are the skillful things that will support us to move towards happiness? What are the things that don't support us? What are the unskillful things? So I like this notion of skillful, unskillful. For me, it takes a lot of the judgment out of it. It's like, if you want to be happiness, this is what you need to do. If you want to learn how to carve wood properly, this is what you need to do. So that what's skillful for us? So skillful states of mind. Actually, I'll talk about unskillful states first. Unskillful states of mind tend to be those that are rooted in greed, in aversion, in delusion. States like anger, frustration, pride, boredom, lust for power, money, despair, aversion. States like that tend to catch us. We tend to be in a state of either mild or profound distress as these states are present for us. Skillful states of mind are those that are not based in greed, aversion, or delusion. These are states such as generosity, kindness, compassion, mindfulness, calm, peace, equanimity. These are states of mind that are worth cultivating. So these five faculties, faith in the practice, faith in the Buddha's awakening, energy directed towards the practice, skillful mindfulness, concentration that supports our understanding, wisdom, infusing all of them. These are wholesome, skillful states to cultivate. So the faculty of energy, this quality of energy, helps us with this exploration around what helps us, what moves us in the direction, what's skillful, what moves us in the direction of happiness, and what moves us in the direction of suffering. So the faculty of energy is a faculty that helps us do that exploration, helps us make that exploration. So we cultivate energy through and direct that energy towards cultivating wholesome states of mind, letting go of cultivating skillful states of mind, letting go of unskillful states of mind. Beginning to understand what is the relationship between skillful states of mind and the movement towards happiness, and what's the relationship between unskillful states of mind and the movement towards suffering. So understanding something about cause and effect. We actually get to see this pretty clearly as we sit down and meditate. The cause and effect nature of our experience and how skillful qualities of mind will lead us towards happiness. Unskillful qualities of mind will lead us towards struggle. It gets revealed to us as we pay attention to our experience. So these two pieces, really, of looking at what helps us and what doesn't help us, and the conditioned nature of experience, the cause and effect nature of experience. These are the two key pieces of wisdom, two of the key pieces of wisdom that kind of underlie our opening to how our minds create our own struggles. So since we don't do energy so much, what is it that helps us to cultivate this quality of energy? I'm just going to go through a few things kind of quickly. What is it that helps us to cultivate this appropriate energy, let's call it, wise energy? What is it that helps us with this? Well, the first piece, the first most important piece is wisdom. Having an understanding, beginning to reflect on how unskillful qualities lead us into struggle, how skillful qualities help to lead us out of struggle. So understanding this, and partly this is, you know, the factor of wisdom, which we'll talk about in a few days, you know, it's got different levels to it. The factor of wisdom has a level of, first of all, just taking in information, hearing wise information, listening to, you know, people speak about the Dharma, reading books about the Dharma, this taking in the information, the perspective, this kind of shift of perspective the Buddha offered us. We have to take it in and begin to understand it at some level. And then, so that's the first level of wisdom. You know, it's not necessarily that wisdom just kind of arises spontaneously in full-blown form in us. We take in information, we reflect on it then. And this is the second level of wisdom. We reflect on it, we contemplate it, we look at, does this make sense for me? How does this make sense for me? And as we engage in the teachings, what we've learned at that level of reflection, it tends to incline us towards actually engaging in those teachings. So we then begin to practice, apply these teachings in our lives, which leads us to the deeper form of wisdom, which is where we actually recognize it experientially, understand in our own hearts and minds the truth of the wisdom which we've been hearing about and reflecting about. So it's not just an abstract thing that we understand. When I act out of aversion, it leads me into suffering. It's a very direct experience that we know that for ourselves. So the energy, you know, so wisdom. Wisdom focuses the energy towards its purpose. And initially, this wisdom that is focusing the energy towards its purpose is kind of borrowed wisdom. It's borrowed from people that we respect. It's borrowed from teachings that we find sensible for us. And then we begin to work with them. So this is the first support for energy. And as we begin to reflect on wise teachings, it inspires this sense of, okay, maybe I should try this. First of all, it inspires a sense of confidence. Okay, this sounds like it might work for me. I'm at least willing to try this, which then moves us towards the energy. So wisdom is a factor that supports our energy. Faith, confidence, is another factor, as I just mentioned, that supports our energy. A sense that what we're trying to do is possible. And then we have to actually want to do this. Now, this is a place where we sometimes get caught. We have this notion in our minds that if we want anything, it means we're clinging and we have to abolish all wants. But to actually engage in the practice, it takes a form of desire. It takes a form of wanting to engage. So there is a wholesome form of desire, a wholesome form of wanting to engage based on wisdom. Do we actually have to want to do this? So this wish, this desire, this aspiration, perhaps, is another way to look at this wish, does inspire a sense of willingness to engage. So again, this is a support for energy. Another beautiful support for energy is curiosity, interest. One of the things I've seen in my own experience is that if I'm curious about something, energy's right there. You know, if I'm curious about wanting to understand something, you know, if I'm curious about how does that work or what is that? If I'm curious, there's a very natural inclination to explore it. And so curiosity, interest, investigation as a form of this as well. Where there's interest, curiosity, energy naturally follows that path. And so part of the question is, can we get interested in our own minds, in our own hearts, in our own experience? And these days, can you get interested in the breath? Is that possible? You know, sometimes it feels nearly impossible to be interested in the breath. And, you know, at times it's just, okay, just another breath, just another breath. But what I've seen over time is that the more I'm willing to just meet, just be with, and this is what one of my teachers, Sayadaw Upandita, talked about, is what investigation actually is a meeting of experience. He used an analogy of rubbing, polishing a bowl with a cloth, that we meet our experience in that way, just the staying in contact, the rubbing, the being with. That's investigation. Sometimes when we hear the word investigation, we think of, you know, digging apart, picking apart, like we're going to like take an ice pick to this thing and start chipping it apart. That would be what we'd think of as investigation. But he's like, more, no, it's more like, you know, just touch, just be with it, just contact, soft cloth, rubbing experience. This patient, gentle meeting of experience. If I'm willing to do that with the breath, with pretty much any experience, interest, it gets really interesting. The breath gets really interesting. Experience gets very interesting. And then energy naturally follows from that. And so it may take a little bit of just kind of, okay, I'm just going to see, what does it mean to meet, to stay in contact with experience? Can I do that? That staying in contact with may tend to generate some interest, some curiosity, which will then naturally generate some energy. One of the main supports for energy is effort. Sometimes these two words are used synonymously, but I'd like to think about the distinction between them. What is the distinction between effort and energy? And the Buddha's texts actually point to it. They say that energy is the factor behind effort, or that allows effort to happen. And so, as I said earlier, we need some kind of energy in our being to make effort. And this is the way we typically think about effort, that we need some energy to make effort. The other side of this equation, though, that's really interesting to explore and to see the truth of it in your own experience, is that energy, this spiritual factor of energy, the spiritual faculty of energy, is defined as the result, or it comes about, it comes about as the result of making wise effort. And so this is turning it around. We make effort and it produces energy. So we start with some level of energy, and if we apply it wisely, if we apply that energy wisely, we make effort, we use that energy to make effort wisely, it will generate more energy, and it will generate skillful energy. So the wise effort of the Buddha, this is a chunk of what I'd like to speak about today. It's a big part of how wise, skillful energy is created, is by engaging with wise effort. So the Buddha explored wise effort and talked about four different ways that we can make wise effort. He said that we, and I'll just name these quickly now and then go through each one and listen to the framing of this. So wise effort is the effort towards the non-arising or the avoidance of unskillful states that are not present right now. So the actual framing of this, the translation, one of the translation is the effort towards the non-arising of unskillful states that have not yet arisen. That's a kind of a hard sentence to take in. Three negatives in that sentence. So I'll go into that in just a moment. So then the effort, the second aspect is the effort towards the abandoning, the letting go of unskillful states that are present, that have arisen in our minds. The third is the effort towards the arousing of skillful states that are not yet present in our minds. So the effort towards creating or growing skillful states in our hearts and minds when they're not yet present. And then the fourth is the effort towards the sustaining of skillful states, those states that are present. So this very definition of wise effort, using this terminology or this understanding around skillful and unskillful, this definition of wise effort already includes wisdom in it. We are orienting our effort towards letting go of those states that take us to suffering, cultivating those states that take us to happiness. So this is the whole framing of wise effort. So this is actually a lot of how our practice works, exploring these four aspects of wise effort. So I'll just talk about each one briefly. So the first, the effort towards the non-arising of unwholesome states that have not arisen. So basically what this means is, you know, if there's... if you know in your own experience that you tend to land in struggle in certain situations, certain causes and conditions will take you down that pathway of struggle. Really helpful to find ways to avoid going down that pathway. So avoiding unwholesome states that have not arisen by knowing, by trial and error in our own minds, we see. By observing in our own minds, as we bring mindfulness to our experience, we start to see what creates struggle for us, what creates suffering. And we begin to see how that's caused. We begin to see the cause and effect relationships. And so seeing the causes of moving towards suffering, we can begin to reorient around those causes. So, you know, you might think, for example, as an example about this, perhaps you notice that when you're standing in line for the lunch in the room downstairs, when you're standing in line, that you tend to get really aversive. You might think something along the lines of, okay, well, one way to avoid the arising of aversion there, so to support the non-arising of the aversion, would be to do walking meditation until the line is gone. That's one way. That is one way to avoid the arising of that aversion. You avoid one of the causes, which is standing in the line. But this teaching is actually asking us to explore a little more deeply than that. Because often when we're looking at the causes like that, you know, we think, okay, the cause of this suffering is that I'm standing in this line. But the cause of the suffering is something more, has to do more with how we're reacting to standing in the line. So the exploration might be, rather than to just avoid the line, begin to explore, what does it mean? How might it be possible to stand in this line? And begin to see what is it that actually makes that aversion to standing in the line happen? So we explore at a deeper level, not just that standing in line creates aversion, so avoid standing in line, but begin to explore what is it about standing in line that causes this aversion to arise in the mind. You might notice many interesting things by doing this. You might notice, you know, impatience being one thing, right? You know, just impatience or hunger. Maybe you're really, really hungry. And that hunger is creating, you know, it's almost like the hunger isn't really felt. And the hunger creates the impatience, which creates the aversion to the wait in the line. Maybe you can find that actually you can hang out with hunger. You know, I actually had this was a major issue for me for quite a long time. I would find that, particularly when I was traveling, if I got really hungry, I actually warned my traveling companions often, you know, when I get really hungry, I get really hard to be with. And I'm going to, you know, want to eat, but I'm not going to be able to pick what to eat. I'm not going to be able to tell you where I want to eat, and I'm going to be yelling at you the whole time. And, you know, I just thought, well, this is the way my body, I mean, at least began to recognize, okay, yeah, this is caused out of the hunger. But I didn't see for a long time that I had any say in the fact that I got so really nasty when I got really hungry. I've been observing this, you know, looking at this process in my experience. And at this point, I get hungry and I know, yeah, I'm really hungry. It's time to get some food. And I don't go to that place of anger, irritation, and being really unpleasant to be around. At least I hope I'm not unpleasant to be around. So that is essentially, you know, through exploring, investigating the experience of hunger, the willingness, okay, here it is, here's the hunger. You know, why does the mind get so frantic over this experience? Why is the mind so frantic over that churning and gurgling in the stomach? Okay, my mind doesn't seem to respond so quickly to make decisions so quickly. That's a piece of it too. Okay, I see that. So just exploring in more, at a deeper level, what is it actually that is the cause of that reactivity? And for myself, I now can say I see the non-arising of that suffering. You know, that suffering does not arise anymore. And I'm sure that you've experienced this kind of thing. Many of you have experienced this kind of non-arising of suffering. Through the practice, you may begin to see that certain situations that you've been in, that would have caused you to become really reactive in the past aren't doing that so much anymore. This is seeing the benefit of wise effort. You start to experience that non-arising of unskillful states. The second kind of right effort is the effort to let go of unskillful states when they're present. So anger arises, frustration arises, greed arises, pride arises, I'm doing great arises. We feel that. So the effort to abandon these unwholesome states when they have arisen, this has some subtlety to it as well. I mean, the kind of simplicity of it is to simply, okay, notice that those unwholesome states are there and let go of them. That's what it sounds like it's saying. Notice that anger is present and let anger go. Sometimes we can do that. My experience is that much of the time, that's not really within the realm of what this mind can do in this moment. But what we can do often is to bring mindfulness to our difficult mind states, to our unskillful mind states. It's essentially a form of letting be around that state of mind, which is an indirect form of letting go. As we let be with mindfulness, as we explore these difficult states with mindfulness, we begin to find that there's a place, a way of being attentive that neither gets hooked into that difficulty, like for instance with anger, that there's a way of being with anger that isn't hooked into the anger and churning around it and believing it and telling ourselves the story of that anger. Oh, that's on one side. Or the other side of it would be saying, bad anger, no, go away, you know, I have to let you go, so I'm going to push you away. That also, I mean, that's essentially anger towards anger or aversion towards anger. So on both sides, we're kind of reinforcing that quality of anger. But there's a place right in the middle path that the Buddha talked about, where we can be with an experience, neither acting on it nor repressing it. And it takes some trust. It takes some trust that that place is findable. And initially, perhaps borrowing the trust, borrowing the confidence from teachers or others that you've spoken to, that this is possible to find this place where you can just open to a difficult state. When you find that place, though, it really quickly becomes apparent how helpful it is. Because you directly feel in the moment a kind of a space around that difficulty. It's no longer whipping you into a frenzy. And it feels like it's just got all the space to kind of flow through. And often we see that it tends to not last that long when we can find that place of balanced perspective around the difficult state. It's kind of like opening a channel to allow that difficult state to flow through and not letting it get hooked on anything. This is a lot of our practice. This is a huge part of our practice, this willingness to explore what does it mean to let something be, and knowing that we're going to fall off on one side or the other. There are going to be times when we go, oh no, I don't want that to happen. How can I stop that? Or times when we get hooked into it. Yeah, they shouldn't have done that. I should figure this out. I need to fix that or change that or make them think the way I think. Either side of that will fall off on either side. That's just part of the exploration. When we see ourselves falling off on either side, oh, there, I've gone into that habit. Okay, just start where you are. Over and over again, start where you are. At times, it can be that when we there's certain states of difficulty that are so difficult for us that we find it is nearly impossible to be mindful of them. You know, that the act of bringing mindfulness to certain states of mind simply kind of hooks us right back into that being caught up in that difficulty. So for myself, anger was a big one for me, and I would find that if I was at a particular period in my practice, if I tried to be mindful of the anger, that the very act of trying to bring mindfulness to it just sucked me right back into the pattern of anger, and I was right back in arguing with this person that I was angry with in my mind. And so if you notice that, essentially sometimes the power or the force of the difficult mind state can be way stronger than our capacity for mindfulness in a moment. And if that's happening, it'll feel like you're overwhelmed. It'll feel like you're getting swamped by that difficult state. If that's happening, really helpful to redirect the attention. Turn the attention to something else. See if you can say in a very non-aversive way, you know, I see you, and I see it's not such a good time to pay attention to you right now, so I'm going to put my attention on something else. Finding something kind of neutral to bring your attention to. Perhaps contact of your feet on the floor, or opening up to the experience of hearing, or maybe taking a walk and looking at the trees, something that you can be present for while the state is kind of overwhelming or swamping you. So it's kind of a skillful ignoring, saying not now. Very helpful to learn when that is appropriate. So the third kind of right effort is the effort to cultivate skillful states that are not active right now, not present right now. There's two ways that this can happen, two ways that this can work. One is that we abstain or hold back from situations that tend to lead us to opposite qualities. And so, for instance, that's part of the reason we engage in the precepts. We're abstaining from actions that tend to lead us into times when unwholesome qualities of mind are at work. So we abstain from harming beings, which in turn then begins to cultivate beautiful qualities of mind. And this is an understanding that these abstaining from certain actions is paired with the cultivation of beautiful qualities. So, for instance, the abstaining from taking life, if you're actually observing and conscious of that, conscious of, okay, I'm not going to hit that spider on the wall. Instead, I'm going to catch it in a cup and I'm going to take it outside. If you're conscious of that, you may begin to recognize a connection with that being and begin to feel a sense of compassion. So abstaining from killing is paired with the cultivation of compassion. Abstaining from taking what's not given is paired with contentment. Abstaining from false speech is paired with truthfulness. So as we abstain from actions that oppose unwholesome qualities of mind, we're actually cultivating wholesome qualities of mind. And we can also actively cultivate wholesome qualities of mind. For instance, if you would like to cultivate the quality of generosity, then practicing giving, practicing dana. Through our meditation practice, we are cultivating many beautiful qualities. We're cultivating all of these faculties. We're cultivating confidence and energy and mindfulness. We're cultivating concentration. Wisdom is growing as we're cultivating our practice. Equanimity is being cultivated as we engage in our practice. So this kind of effort to arouse wholesome mind states that have not yet arisen is a big part of what's going on, even if you're not consciously thinking about it. The fourth kind of wise effort is the effort to sustain wholesome states, skillful states, that are present. And when I heard this one first, I thought, well, why would that take effort? You know, why would it be effortful to sustain something that felt good or that was beautiful? And I discovered in looking at my own mind, there's a couple different ways that we can get into trouble around this, you know, ways that it is helpful to apply effort to sustain wholesome qualities of mind. One of the ways I personally find I tend to get in the way of sustaining wholesome qualities of mind is because I kind of don't, it's almost like it's hard to be in those places or something. You know, when I find I'm in a really calm or peaceful place or a lot of joy, it's like, whoa, I'm not used to this. How do I deal with this? Or, you know, I remember on one retreat, I came to this really tranquil place of mind, you know, calm. Mine was so calm and quiet. And the first thing that my mind thought of to do with that was, oh, wow, the mind's really calm. This is the perfect time to pay attention to that pain in my back. You know, not letting myself really settle into the calm, but like, oh, let's do something here. So another way that we tend to get in the way of these states is by holding on to them, by grasping them, by, oh, this is fantastic, I want more of this, or how can I hold on to, how can I keep this going? And you may find in your experience that, you know, as calm comes and it's like, oh, this is fantastic, the next thing that comes is it's gone. So how can we sustain wholesome states that have arisen? And it's kind of a similar balance point to working with the difficult states, you know, that we can fall off on one side or the other. With the wholesome states, we can either, you know, grab onto them and want to have more of them, or we can kind of go, oh, I can't handle that. That's way too intense. Too much joy here. I can't deal with that. There's a place, being mindful. Can we be mindful? Can we open to, oh, this is arising right now? Mindfulness is a great way to sustain wholesome states. Pay attention to them. Appreciate them. See if you can find that middle ground where you're neither running away from them or trying to hold on to them. And again, it will be falling off on either side. Some of you may have more of the tendency to grab onto them. Some of you may have more of the tendency to go, oh, can't deal with that. Just notice your own tendency. Can you open to that? It's kind of like going off on either side, we begin to find that middle ground. So no need to give yourself a hard time when you find yourself kind of falling off on one side or the other. It's just you've wandered into that terrain. It's that you can learn from that terrain. You can learn from the terrain of grasping. It's like, okay, well, grasping has arisen. I guess I can pay attention to grasping right now. Okay, that's what's going on. To not feel like I've done something wrong. It's just, oh, the mind is habitually, this is a kind of the habitual tendency. I'm familiar with this place of grasping to wholesome, to beautiful states. So recognizing the beautiful qualities also as they arise in our practice. So I was talking about being mindful of them, but there's also a way that sometimes these beautiful states start to arise. States of concentration or calm or mindfulness or generosity or confidence, that they appear in our minds, but we don't actually recognize them as being there. So beginning to kind of tune your awareness to recognize, oh, that's what confidence is. That's what generosity feels like. As you attune yourself to them, you attune yourself, and that's what mindfulness is, you know, this experience of waking up into the moment. That's what mindfulness is. So we begin to attune ourselves to these various qualities by actually recognizing them. It's almost like they begin to point themselves out to us when they happen more and more often. They can sometimes just slide right by us. We don't see them, and we don't thereby get the benefit of being able to nurture them. So we can nurture them by simply recognizing when they're present. I remember on one retreat, I was experiencing a lot of pain around the area of my heart, and I couldn't even do sitting meditation. It was just too difficult, and so I was doing a lot of walking. And while I was walking, at some point, the mind recognized, oh, at least I'm cultivating patience right now. And that was a really powerful recognition. You know, it sustained me in the being with the difficulty to recognize that patience was being cultivated. So another aspect of energy, of wise energy, is recognizing how to balance it. Energy can be out of balance in our system. Too much energy in our system is often experienced as restlessness or anxiety. Too little energy is often experienced as sleepiness or dullness. So it's helpful to recognize when our energy is kind of out of balance. The energy levels change from moment to moment, hour to hour, day to day. There's kind of, can be kind of flows. You may get familiar with particular cycles of energy for yourself through the day. Some people have more energy earlier in the day, and then it wanes later in the day. Others feel like it builds over the day. You're just getting going in the middle of the afternoon. So being familiar and attuned with your own level of energy allows you to, as Gil was pointing out the other day, make the best effort you can given the level of energy that's present. So with respect to balancing energy, one of the keys for balancing energy in my own experience has been balancing how I make my effort, because effort and energy are intimately connected. So the way we make our effort is crucial in terms of balancing the level of energy that we have. So if we don't have a lot of energy in a moment, you know, if it feels like we're in a low energy place, we might think, oh, really need to apply a strong effort here. And strong effort often means somehow holding on to the breath, or, you know, sitting down and really kind of, yes, I'm going to be sit here for half an hour and I'm going to pay attention to every breath. It's almost like we pick up the entire sitting in the first moment of the sitting and bring the energy, it's like we bring in as much energy as we can muster to try to be present for as long as we can. And that kind of use of energy to make strong effort in that way tends to not be so helpful. You know, it's actually much more helpful to make a very light amount of effort. You know, it's not hard to be mindful for a moment, just right now. Be aware of a breath, an in-breath, an out-breath. How hard is it? It's not very hard for a moment. For 2 seconds, it's not very hard to do that. What is harder is to sustain it over time, to keep it going. But I think we misunderstand how to use our energy, how to apply our effort to keep it going. We think we have to kind of gather it all up at the beginning, all of our energy up at the beginning. But it's more helpful to make a little bit of effort for a short time. Just a tiny bit of effort. Half a breath, as I spoke about this morning. Just enough energy to be present for half a breath. That's all you need to do. And then do it again. Do it again. And do it again. This way you can kind of pull yourself along, you know. If you've got low energy, you can pull yourself along in this way. I do this in the walking meditation also. If I find my mind particularly scattered or restless, and I find it's really hard to be present in the moment, I'll look at the path and I'll pick like a little leaf, you know, two steps out. And I say, okay, can I be mindful until I get to that leaf? I did that, okay. And then I pick something else, that stain on the driveway. Can I be mindful until I get to there? And picking small chunks to do it in. In this way, also pulling yourself along. This kind of way of making effort can balance out our energy, whether we are in a low energy state or a high energy state. Sometimes when we're in a high energy state, our mind is just, you know, it stays for a breath and then it's like, zoom, it just flies out. So the gentle, okay, can I be present for half a breath? And then feeling that pull out to thinking that restless energy. Oh, okay, can I do it again? Can I do it again? So this ease of effort, light touch over and over and over again, really, really helpful for balancing our energy. Another trick that I use, I tend to be an over-efforter. So I tend to sit down and it's like, yes, be present, do this, I'm going to do it. And one question I began asking myself is, how little effort do I need to make right now in order to be mindful? Boy, I found I could really back off on the level of effort I was making. So that kind of question can be an interesting one if you tend to over-effort. If you tend to under-effort, then kind of keeping that gentle persistence going. Okay, you know, not trying to, say, force yourself to be present, but for this 2 seconds, can I be present? And then again, can I do it again? And again, and again. Really, really helpful way to practice. And then we need to begin to learn. This is really the art of meditation, actually. You know, beginning to see, how do we make effort in a way that's relaxed and easeful? Tuning our level of effort to the level of energy that we have. And when we have been making effort for a little while, it's almost like the energy gets rolling. And we need to be attuned to that. We need to kind of be sensitive to the fact that, okay, you know, actually right now, the mind is pretty present. And I don't need to remind myself every half breath to be present. Actually, that feels kind of agitating to remind myself every half breath. But I can hang out with 2 or 3 breaths with ease. So this is kind of beginning to learn, when is it that the energy gets a little wobbly, or when is it that the mindfulness kind of begins to lose its contact with the experience. I sometimes use this analogy about a scooter, that making effort in this way is kind of like, you know, learning to ride a scooter. You know, initially, you have to tap, 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 tap on the ground to get the momentum going. But then after the momentum is going, if you're continuing to tap, tap, tap on the ground, you're kind of getting in the way of the ride. So if you begin to get a sense of that ride, the momentum of the scooter, and after a while, you begin to get a sense of when you need to tap again, because, oh, it's getting a little wobbly. If I don't tap again, I'll fall over. And likewise, we begin to get a sense in our mindfulness practice, as the energy begins to grow and the mindfulness kind of rides on that energy, we begin to get a sense of how much effort do we need to make. We may not need to remind ourselves every half breath. We may be able to stay present for an entire path without too much reminding. So exploring and tuning the level of effort to what's happening in your experience. I'll finish with a quote. This is from a Thai monk, Pia Disitera. And it's kind of really a framing about how energy and effort lie in our own hands and how our own awakening lies in our own hands. We must, by our own resolute efforts, rise and make our way to the portals of liberty. And it is always in every moment in our power to do so. Neither are those portals locked and the key in possession of someone else from whom it must be obtained by prayer or entreaty. That door is free of all bolts and bars, save those we ourselves have made. One teacher said, "It is entirely through the spiritual power of energy that awakening happens." So attuning yourself to this quality, making the effort for yourself, and seeing for yourself the benefit. Thank you for your attention.